Hey, welcome to another episode of Life 2.0 Podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. We're going to turn the clock back on this Throwback Thursday, back 5 years to 2015, and a conversation with a guy that I think ranks in the top probably 10 guests that I've ever had in radio. I'm talking ever had across thousands of shows in 20-plus years, a gentleman named Christian Piccolini, who... Listen, with all that's going on in the world, and quite frankly, always has been going on in the world, but now with social media or unsocial media, depending how you look at it, pervades every avenue and aspect of our being, which is not good for us. On the other hand, if we take this information in and we can actually do something with it and transform it into positive action, then I'm all for it. So this conversation took place 5 years ago on a podcast that I did for CBS and working on another project that I had to submit some audio for. I came across a conversation, I was doing some editing, and I thought, here we go again. This has to be heard one more time, so let's get to it. I'm big about having takeaways from these shows. You listen to it. Some of the shows are just like last week was Jaws, was just meant to have some fun and relax and roll back 45 years. This time it's 5 years. And there are some serious takeaways in here with this conversation I had with Christian Piccolini, who is a former skinhead. Matter of fact, arguably the guy that created the whole skinhead movement in the United States, right here in a suburb of Chicago called Blue Island. And I'm listening to this podcast. I'm listening to the story of this man. And once again, the lesson or my takeaway comes from that the rest of us, unless you've been intimately involved in some sort of movement like this, which he's the only guy that I know that actually has, those are the people we should be paying attention to. The rest of us, it's just all lip service, including myself at times. When I was talking with George Hawthorne a few podcasts back about the challenge that is faced by black men and women and children in this country, it was a real eye-opener for me. And I don't know what it's like to have my skin a different color than it is. I've never had any problems with anybody of a different race, quite frankly. Most of the problems I have with the idiots that I have to deal with it are of my own race. But across the board, that was a really eye-opening conversation with George, and I got a lot of feedback on that. And this conversation is just as important. This is a guy who... Again, I'm laughing only because I don't know how to fill that space with anything but that. It's not funny, any of it. But it's fascinating to me how when there's a problem in the world that shows up in the headlines, for the most part, our answers only come from our own experience. There's no other way we can do it. So I'm watching the landfill of Facebook this past week, and of course it's blowing up with all sorts of things. That's nothing new. And I'm watching white people making the argument of what should be done to change the lives of black people. And that's not possible without conversation. It's just opinion. And so having conversation with someone who has had those experiences is really the key. So I watched a guy put up a Facebook post about he didn't understand what was going on with some of the Black Lives Matter movement and how it pertained to black-on-black crime. And Chicago is rift with this stuff. I mean, it's like every weekend now, because it's warm out, the crime rate's going to go up and the murders are going to go up, and black-on-black crime dominates the headlines. So we sit here trying to understand what we can't, trying to make sense out of the senseless and doing something to find the obvious buried in the absurd. And as I watched him make these comments, and they're his opinion, and he means well by it because he's bothered by it, not one person who chimed in was of a different race. It was all white people trying to decide what is right and wrong in all that's going on in black America. I can't do anything except try to understand it the best I can, but I realize that none of this comes from any political will, meaning you can't pass legislation for morality. And so I tend to do things one-on-one. That's where I'm most effective. I can do this podcast and make some observations and some suggestions from my own experiences, but I certainly don't have any blanket answers because I'm not black. And I don't know what that's like. And so until you've had the experience, all the rest of us come up with conjecture from our own backgrounds, and that's all we can do. That's why one-on-one conversations, one-on-one relationships with people who are of a different race, a different religion, even different political persuasion, those are important. Doesn't solve anything, but maybe that's the place where the bridges of understanding are built. They're certainly not built in the headlines. They're certainly not built in political debate or any other kind of debate on Facebook. Facebook is a landfill where we put all kind of shit in there. And then we got to sort it out and see what works and what doesn't. For the most part, it's frustrating. The big takeaway that I got from the conversation you're about to hear with Christian Piccolini, battling each other over ideology changes nothing. It actually just pushes people back further into their corners. So it's having conversation, not arguing over ideology, that is where real change comes from. One-on-one with people. If you hold yourself accountable in your sphere of influence, that's a good thing. Getting out, telling the rest of the world how it should be because I see it this way, that never works. Anyway, from 2015, an eye-opening and just riveting conversation with a guy who knows what it's like to be on the other end of this, where most of us never spend time in the skinhead movement. Listen and learn. Welcome back to Life Matters. Glad to have you with me one more time this week. My opinion, best 50 frickin' minutes you're going to spend. I mean, you could do some other stuff that would be fun, but nothing's going to inform, entertain maybe, but definitely inspire you like this show. It's what I've been doing for 20 years. It's interesting to me. People connect and say, hey, you know, where'd you come from? I'm like, hey, why weren't you listening earlier? Because I've been doing this shit for 20 years. I am all about the things and the concepts and the ideas and the activity, all the things that can go into making life a little bit better than it was before I got here. I take enough space up on the planet. I want to do something with it. When I was a kid growing up here in Chicago, we had this floor-to-ceiling bookshelf, or bookcase, I should say. It wasn't a shelf. It was full of bookshelves. And there had to be 500 books in there. And my father, who was a banker, would every other day or so would walk out and get a book, and he'd take it with him to work. And he would, you know, take the book out, look at it, put it back. And I'd be sitting at the table, you know, nailing a thing, a Captain Crunch or something. And I'd see my dad take these books out. And the love of reading, I mean, we only had four channels, though. Who gives a shit back then? But the love of reading really got into me. And he would never tell me to read anything. He would say, you might want to look at this, getting my curiosity going. So when a book comes across my nose, and I've read thousands of books, and something can move me in a way that is not normal when I read a book, then something's going on there. And I got to give out a shout out to my friend KVG. You know, Katie got a hold of me last week, and she said, there's this guy you got to meet, and you really need to put him on your show. And I said, okay. Now, Katie gets a little leeway because she worked for me and with me, and she helped work on Earth Matters. So I listened to that stuff, and she said, it's a book about a guy who's a skinhead. Well, he used to be a skinhead. He's not a skin anymore. Well, you just got to read the book. So I got the book, and the book is called Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. And I have not been able to put this down since Tuesday when it arrived at the house. And I have all these pages dog-eared and marked up and stuff like that. Christian Piccolini is sitting here in the studio with me. He's the author of the book. It is something, if they haven't made it into a movie, at some point they're going to have to. The foreword is by Joan Jett. And I'm really just honored that he'd take time out of his busy schedule. Can we say it that way to have you in the studio? Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me, John. I really appreciate being here.
Well, when a book comes across my nose like this and I can't put it down, something, there's a message in there for me. And the first thing I got, number one, is it takes some serious nads to do this, because I can't imagine going against the grain of what you believe since you were 14 for a certain amount of time and then writing about it and putting it out to the world and saying, I'm not this guy anymore. And there's a major lesson in that. So when was the impetus to actually put this together? What was there a catalyst to say, I have to write my story?
Well, I left the white power skinhead movement in 1995, and for 5 years after that, I went through a major depression. I'd lost everything. I'd lost my wife and children. I'd lost my livelihood. I lost my parents because I didn't have a great relationship with them. And I lost my whole social structure, because when I left the movement, that was my family. So I went through a really dark depression for 5 years, where I contemplated taking my life, and I got into drugs and alcohol, and didn't really know where I wanted my life to be. My heart had changed. You know, I went from somebody who was a racist from the time of 14 to 22. But because I had met people who'd showed me compassion and people who I'd alienated from my circles, they started to become friends of mine, and the ideology just didn't make any sense anymore. As part of this depression, I didn't talk about my past. I tried to outrun it. And I thought, you know, I'll move. I'll make new friends. I'll just get past it. And it was eating me from the inside out, the fact that I hadn't talked about it. And then one day in 1999, a friend of mine approached me. I was out of work at the time and approached me about a temp job at IBM. And I said, I don't know anything about technology. I'm covered in tattoos. I'm the last person that IBM wants to hire. But, you know, I filled out a resume. I think I lied a little bit on it, and I submitted it, and I got the job. And the first place, literally out of the millions of places that IBM could have put me, they placed me at my old high school for a computer rollout, the same high school I'd been kicked out of twice. And I was terrified. And on the first day there, you know, I assumed everybody was going to point me out. Administrators were still there from when I was there years prior and had a restraining order. But on the first day there, I saw the old black security guard I'd gotten in a fist fight with to get kicked out. And I didn't know what to do. I was terrified. I thought I was going to lose my job. I thought, you know, everything was going to come crashing down. And I decided I was going to run after him. And I caught him in a parking lot, and I tapped him on the shoulder. And his normally jolly face turned into a scowl when he recognized who I was. And all I could say was, I'm sorry. And we talked for a little while. And he stuck out his hand and shook it, and we both cried, and the heavens opened up, and it felt like redemptive light had embraced us. And he made me promise that I would tell my story. And this was a person who I'd put through hell. I mean, I
yeah, there's some chapters in there that are just freaking brutal. The stuff that was said between you and him and the principal and these things.
Yeah.
But let's go back to 14, because one of the things that I talk about in this show all the time is almost a DNA download, that so much of what we believe to be true about the world seems to be in place by the time we're 8 or 10. Apparently it skipped you.
It did.
Because as I'm reading about your life, outside of your dad having a Corvette and kind of doing his thing and your mom doing her thing and being like, you had a good life.
I had a pretty good life. I grew up on the south side of Chicago. My parents were Italian immigrants who came to this country in the mid-60s to search for their slice of the American pie. They wanted a better life. I came from a really great family. We were a lower middle class family, working class. And, you know, I had a lot of love surrounding me, but my parents worked a lot. And because they worked a lot, I was kind of left to my own vices. And, you know, I was a pretty lonely kid. I was
kind of open to something that might come along.
Yeah, but I wasn't raised with any sort of prejudice. Because
that's the point, right?
My parents were often the victims of prejudice when they came to this country.
There was a time back then. I'm trying to draw a string if possible. There's so many events that occurred in your life as I'm reading your book, Romantic Violence, that they seem to be connected. I couldn't quite find the connected dots, but there was this one time you were being picked on by a bully who was a hell of a lot bigger than you, and you cold-cocked this kid, basically.
Yeah.
And it kind of was a role reversal. He'd been kind of stalking you and smaller kids for a long time. It's the typical thing that happens. Here's this, the Goliath, basically, and that happens. There was a sense that I got out of reading the book and that experience that gave you a sense of power that, even though it came through someone else's pain, was something you were looking for.
Yeah, you know, for most of my life, I was picked on. I grew up in an Italian neighborhood in Blue Island, but my parents moved us to kind of a white suburban neighborhood of Oak Forest. So I straddled two cultures, and I didn't really fit into either one. The Italian kids from Blue Island saw me as the outsider who, you know, was the quote-unquote rich kid, which we weren't. We were poor. And the kids from Oak Forest saw me as a foreigner, which I was. And my parents, you know, had a hard time speaking English, and we had different customs. So I didn't really fit in with either one. And the situation that you're describing is the first chapter of the book. When I got in a fight with this bully, and I was terrified, and he had picked on me for years and years and years, as well as other people, and I saw no other choice. It was kind of a self-preservation thing. You know, my muscles tensed up, and when, you know, we had this fight, I threw the first punch, knocked him out, and then the power was intoxicating. It was something that I didn't let go of for 7 years. And it was a catalyst. It was kind of the end of my innocence, I think, that moment.
So if you take that moment and then you add to it the time that the 69 Firebird comes pulling up in the alley and spitting gravel left and right, and you're sitting out there smoking a Mary Jane, kind of just hanging out with the fellas. It was almost like it was ripe for the picking. for a guy like you?
Well, I think, you know, these recruiters are pretty savvy. So the situation that you're describing was when I was standing in an alley smoking a joint, and the car pulls up, and out of this car comes this guy with a shaved head and shiny black boots. And this was 87, so nobody really knew what a skinhead was in the United States at that time. And he made a beeline towards me, and he looked at me, and he pulls the joint out of my mouth, and he says, "Don't you know that that's what the capitalists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile?" I didn't know what a capitalist was at 14. I didn't know, you know, what it, I don't think I'd ever met a Jewish person, and I hardly knew what the word docile meant. But I was struck with his charisma and his power. He wasn't telling me to not do something like my dad might have, like, "Oh, that's stupid, don't do that." He actually gave me a reason that showed me he cared about me. And from that moment on, I was infatuated with this guy who turned out to be America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader.
Hmm. Interesting the choice of words. You say this guy gave me something that he cared about me in just moments, or after a very short amount of time. You're with your parents your whole life. There's a rebellious part, as any kid is at 14 or 15. It's almost like there's an opening there. And as I went through the book, I'm starting to see, again, this connected. So here this connects to this, and this connects to this, and this connects to this. When you were writing the book, and you put down these experiences, and you relive them again, because, and quite frankly, just in the sense of good taste, there's a lot of words in there that I don't mind using, but we're not going to use them here, because I know a lot of people are listening in different ethnicities. But to go from the kid who couldn't wait to get baseball cards and hang out and do those things to just in months becoming this other kid, I just found that transformation not only fascinating, but very telling. But when you're back and writing all this and reliving it again, what's that feel like?
Well, it was a really cathartic experience for me to be able to write it. It took me 10 years to write
10 years to write
yeah,
this.
It started out as a 20-page paper as my entrance paper for DePaul University.
Really?
Yeah. And it was, you know, just a small slice of what the book is about. But when my counselor and my mentor read it, he said, you know, you should really think about making this into a book. And I did think about it. And, you know, at first I wanted to write the book and self-publish it because I wanted to just give it away. I wanted to give it to schools and to impressionable young kids. It kind of just grew from there. But it was a therapeutic, cathartic experience. And I think I learned a lot about myself in writing it. And I think I confronted a lot of issues of my vulnerability in writing it. It definitely opened my eyes to kind of who I was, why I got in, what happened during my time in, and why I got out.
Because this to me is not just about a skinhead who believes X, Y, and Z and then becomes this. I think I saw so much myself in here. And I think anybody looks at our prejudices, our thoughts or ideas, and we're mostly unwilling to confront them.
It's scary to hold up a mirror to the bad things in your own society.
I remember getting in fights and beating up. I was a bouncer for 3 years, and sometimes the best thing to do is wait till a guy got drunk and put him over a fire hydrant. Mm. That's not right.
No.
I felt bad about it years later. But I look at these things and I go, look at the bits and pieces of me in here, even though they're different experiences. And I think that's what the journey people are on can do for each other. So many of the things, I mean, you lost friends. You almost killed your mother, you know, through a window. The confrontations at the school with the principal. And I'm thinking, it's almost like a totally different human showed up for a while. And then almost as quickly as it was done, it started to become undone, almost as if it was planned to a degree.
Yeah. You know, it's funny, when you hate yourself so much, to cover that up and to project that and to remove that hate from yourself, we put that on other people. And that's exactly what I did. I mean, I was at a point at 14 years old where I really disliked who I was. I was insecure. I had low self-esteem. I didn't know where I fit in.
Isn't it almost normal for 14-year-olds, right?
Absolutely. I think that's why recruiters in these movements are so savvy to target young people, because that's the age, you know, 13, 14, 15 is the age when young people are breaking away from the influence of their parents. They're starting to create an identity for themselves, and they're confused.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was targeted at 14, and, you know, I was a completely different person because I had recognized that I was not happy with who I was. So in order to deflect that unhappiness, I projected it onto other people. And because I hated myself, I forced myself to hate other people more than I hated myself.
Was the most difficult parts of the book for me to read was the confrontation of the things with your parents, because these are people who really didn't do anything wrong. And it seemed for a while the brunt of all this fell to them. There was an incident about you and your dad. You came in late, midnight on a school night, and it turns into something bad. And and your mom gets your finger caught in the door and it's bleeding all over the place, and you felt bad, but you had to still be the tough guy at that point. And the conflict was already there, but it seems like they a lot of this they had to deal with before you ever took it out in the world.
Yeah, you know, I give my parents a lot of credit, and I wouldn't be sitting in this chair right now if it wasn't for their constant support through thick and thin. And, you know, I think my parents believed in me. They knew who I was prior to 14. They knew the real person. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and a lot of people ask me, too, when I do public speaking, you know, do people believe that you've really changed? And I said, well, I haven't changed. I'm still the same person I was when I was born until the age of 14.
You took a little detour, yeah.
I took a little bit of a detour, and you know, while it was a pretty horrific detour that I wouldn't wish on anybody, I learned a lot from that experience, and I think it made me the person who I am today, and it reinforced the person who I was prior to being introduced to this violent movement.
I look at the cover is you, but it's also a picture of the form of you doing the Sieg Heil to Hitler. I'm almost fascinated, again, because of the, how do we use these words? We could say light and dark or energies or whatever you want to call it. And sometimes the greatest teachings we get come from the darkest parts of our lives. And yet we're so reticent not to go there that we skip them or we overlook them. And this was pretty hard to overlook. I mean, you were on television, you were in front of a punk rock band, as you know, doing all the white supremacy. This was not something you just did in your friend's basement. You were the face of all of this for a very long time, very public.
Yeah, I think what most people don't recognize about the American skinhead movement is that it was born in Chicago, on the south side of Chicago.
Another thing we can claim, right? Yeah. Yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah, beef sandwiches and neo-Nazi skinheads.
Yeah, sandwich.
But because of that, you know, I was really introduced to it at a very young age, and you know, the neighborhood was changing, and, you know, I would ride my little red bike around the neighborhood, and then eventually, after I was recruited, you know, I would ride my bike a little bit closer to this group of individuals who were standing in the alley, who I now really held on a pedestal because they looked tough. Mm-hmm. They acted tough. They listened to cool music. They drank. And I became a little bit of their flunky. So I, you know, I'd go get them
beer.
You
were the gopher, yeah.
And I was the gopher. I'd go buy them cigarettes back when a 14-year-old could do that, at the corner store.
Get some smokes and cokes.
Right. And then 3 weeks later, my bike was stolen and I was beaten up by three black kids. So everything that didn't make sense to me that they were saying suddenly, you know, became crystal clear to me. Blacks were moving into my neighborhood to commit crimes. Latinos were bringing in drugs. And you know, of course, it was completely false because my parents were not at work. And a lot of the things that they were saying didn't make sense. But because I was beaten up by those three black kids, I needed somebody to blame. And they gave me a reason and a person to blame.
You tracked down that bike.
I did.
Tell that story, please, before we go to break in a minute. Because this, to me, was another one of those, your mom get, you know, this is all going on. Your mom gets her finger caught in the door. You feel bad, but you can't show it. Your bike gets stolen. You track it down. The kid is found. You go to the house, and you had compassion there, too, but you couldn't show it. Tell me about that.
So I was, you know, 14 years old, and this bike was really the only thing that I had that I could claim as my own. It represented my freedom. When I was beaten up and the bike was stolen, you know, it was a pretty traumatic time for me. So I wanted that bike back because it really represented the only thing that was important to me at the time. I got a tip from a friend on the baseball team, little league team, who said he saw my bike. I walked over to the housing project and walked up a couple stairs, saw it on the balcony, and I knocked on the door. And I didn't know what was going to happen. And when the door opened, a big burly black guy opened it, and I said, "Hey, that's my bike on your balcony." And he screamed out his son's name and asked him if he had stolen the bike, and he said he did. And the kid was terrified of his father. He was a big guy. And when he admitted to it, the father proceeded to beat him brutally right in front of me and handed me my bike and said, "Don't be stupid enough to get it stolen." And here I'm, you know, conflicted because while I wanted my bike back, I certainly didn't want anybody to get hurt like I was hurt, especially by their father. And, you know, I kind of walked away from that experience thinking, you know, violence is a really powerful thing. And like that fight that I had in eighth grade with the bully, this seemed to reinforce that. People with power tend to get things accomplished. So I was really intoxicated by the power that I received while part of this movement.
The book is called Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skidhead, and Christian Picciolini. Is that what I'm saying it right?
Picciolini.
Picciolini.
You got it.
I'm getting there. Couldn't put this down. The forward, it's probably one of the best forwards to a book I've ever read by Joan Jett. You all know who I'm talking about. This from cover to cover is a stunning piece of work. The honesty in it, the brutality in it, only equal, I think, to his ability to to see yourself in this. I don't know if other people have told you this.
I've heard that.
But man, this is really something else. We'll take a short time out. Take care of the people that take care of us. This is another one of these episodes with a specific intent to inform and entertain and inspire to you to have a different consciousness about life. Listen, I'm not a life coach. My grandmother was a life coach, especially when she had a wooden spoon in her hand. And what I think happens most for us is that life is our school. And the classes we take, we have to have tests in them. And you never get to figure out what the lesson is beforehand. You got to wait till after the test. I can't study for this stuff. You just have to go through it. And that leads me to my guest today. I'm just thrilled to have Christian Picciolini in the studio. I'm sorry, I just got to say it that way. Is that offensive to you, by the way?
No.
Oh, good. Because it's too late if it is anyway, right? The book is called Romantic Violence, Memoirs of American Skinhead. Look, I'm worried about offending you saying Picciolini.
I've been called worse.
I'm sure you have. I'm going to read this from the back of the book. At 14 years old, Christian Picciolini, a bright and well-loved child from a good family, had been targeted and trained to spread a violent racist agenda, quickly ascending to a highly visible leadership position in America's first neo-Nazi skinhead gang. So how did this young boy from the suburbs of Chicago, Illinois, who had so much going for him, become so lost in extremist ideologies that would horrify any decent person? That's what this conversation is about. He's in the studio with me. I'm going to say this at least four more times in this next 25 minutes we have here together or so. Go buy this book. Where do they get it?
You can buy it on Amazon or go to your local bookstore and ask for it.
I remember when Amazon was just a river. Those were good days, but now you can get the book there. The reason I'm saying to go buy this is because we live in a... I'm going to get back to your stuff in a minute, but I don't want to... This is kind of fresh in my head. We are in as turbulent of waters... I say that every 4 years. Politics brings it out the best and the worst in all of us. And this is when Facebook people get deleted and blocked. And people. So, you know, for 48 and some odd months, we're all okay with each other. And all of a sudden, politics sprout up and everybody hates each other again. I read your book and I'm going, the politics of hate that it takes to run a neo-Nazi organization and to incite that, is it a stretch to say that it's similar tactics to incite people when it comes to politics and these things that divide us?
Absolutely. It's about fear-mongering. I think, you know, ignorance breeds fear and fear breeds hate, and hate manifests itself as violence. And I think what we're seeing now with, you know, the rhetoric that's being, you know, spewed by a lot of these politicians who are running for the highest office in the world, really, is not that different. As a matter of fact, it's not different at all than the same stuff that I used to preach. They're just using nicer words. They may not be using, you know, things like the N-word like I did, but, you know, they're xenophobes. It's anti, you know, Islamic. It's anti-immigrant. It's anti-foreigner. It's very isolationist, and it's fear-mongering. It's about appealing to, you know, and I hate to say this, but it's about...
Say it, because I need you to say it, because if you're not, I will. Go ahead.
It's about appealing to the lowest common denominator and instilling fear in them so that they'll rally around a cause.
So the 14-year-old boy in the alley smoking a joint, the car rolls up, says, hey, don't you know what's going on? It's their fault your life is this way.
Right.
A lot of the political rhetoric is saying to people, hey, you're disenfranchised. You're not part of the group. I can make you part of the group. We can make this America great again. And I'll do it. You could be with me.
Right.
Same thing?
Same thing. It's not your fault. Blame somebody else.
Yeah.
It's always somebody else's fault.
Yeah. This book also, though, is filled with personal responsibility. There were, without rewinding too much, you had these, I think it was three events that really started chipping away at the armor of all this.
Yeah.
And they all involved violence and almost killing some, your mom, for example.
Right.
You were really a hair trigger away from taking your mom's life.
Yeah, you know, at that time, I think I was probably around 17 or 18 at the time, you know, there was a lot of violence. We perpetuated a lot of the violence, and there was a lot of violence targeted at us for our beliefs. Because of that, we felt the need to arm ourselves to protect ourselves. And you know, we had started some shit a couple of weeks before. And I had a couple of guns, one of which was a sawed-off shotgun. And one night after I'd come home really late from work, I heard somebody rustling outside my window. I'd lived in the basement apartment of my parents at the time. And when I heard somebody rustling around, I reached for my shotgun. I crawled up against the wall. I threw back the curtains and I stuck the shotgun into the face of the person who was on the other side of the window. And as it turned out, it was my mother. She was worried about me. So she was, you know, spying on me and trying to understand what I was about, because I certainly didn't talk to them. I wasn't, you know, very forthcoming with them about what I was involved in. And I almost pulled the trigger until I realized that it was my mother, and almost became half an orphan that night.
Yeah. There's a lot of stories in this book that were very riveting to me, and I think your mom deserves like a halo or something after going through this stuff.
She is a saint.
Yeah. And you look at this, and I'm trying to imagine you, because first of all, you know, you're a very good writer. You've been able to capture this, and I'm full disclosure, I asked you before we came in there, did you really write this, or did you hire? Because if this is your, this, if you created this out of the experience for a decade, the imagery that creates is very powerful. Mm-hmm. I could actually see you in the basement pulling a curtain back with that shotgun, and your mother simply worried about her son. Mm-hmm. Polarized way, you're in the basement thinking you're going to be attacked, and she's simply checking on you.
Right.
I had to put the book down for a second. I literally had to put the, I thought, because if my opinion was, and I may be wrong on this, if you'd have pulled that trigger, this doesn't get written.
No, it doesn't. Or it gets written from a very different place.
Yeah, with bars on it or something, right? So when you look at those pivot points, and you know, you have a few more in the book, and you look at those pivot points that all contributed to this, I was thinking about the other one when the this gang comes in. There's a black guy with a swastika on his forehead coming to your shop, and you're sitting there with a gun in your back of your pants, thinking they're to rub you out or take you out, or and they just wanted to buy some skinhead music. It was kind of odd. Here's this black guy.
Yeah.
Can you explain it? Because I can't explain. I'm like, how the hell does this happen?
So the guy that I talk about in my book is a bit of an anomaly. He's almost a legend in Chicago. And he is a black anti-racist skinhead with a swastika tattooed on his forehead.
Can you start just one more time with that?
He is a black anti-racist skinhead with a swastika tattooed on his forehead.
And he's still alive?
As far as I know, he's still alive.
All right.
You know, we were at odds with, you know, with other skinhead groups. And I think that's something that most people don't understand, is there are different types of skinheads. There are racist skinheads, which is what everybody kind of equates with the word. But there are also anti-racist skinheads whose mission is to battle the white power racist skinheads.
Wait. This is starting to sound like one of those movies with the lichens and the vampires, right. You know? Go ahead.
Yeah, the Sookie Stackhouse.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so there are different types of skinheads.
Good skinheads fighting the bad skinheads, but they're all skinheads.
Okay. Yeah, it's kind of like politicians, right, okay. I guess.
Yeah, nicely done.
But yeah, so this guy came into the store, and, you know, of course, my instinct was he's here to kill me or to do something else. And I always kept a 9mm under the counter because I was selling white power music. And this was a time, 1990, 91, before the consumer internet as we know it. Mm-hmm. So I was selling white power music behind the counter. And that was my purpose when I opened a store, was to sell this white power music that
I'd been
involved in. I don't know that there was big money in it, but there was definitely a very niche target. Mm. And people were driving from all over the country to come to my store to buy this
stuff. But I mean, he dropped like $300 that day. Which was big money for the day.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I never saw him again, so it was kind of like the one-time purchase. Yeah. But he came in to buy...
And he used a credit card.
He used a credit card to buy white power music. And, you know, it's kind of an unwritten thing in the skinhead movement, you know, when people listen to this band called Screwdriver, which is really kind of the godfather of white power rock and roll, a band from Britain. You know, anti-racist skinheads will say that they only listen to their early stuff, which is not racist. And I don't know. I think it's
before they were country.
Yeah, before they were country. I think it's a big lie. But anyway, you know, the music was hard to find. It wasn't. Yeah. It had to be imported, and it was expensive. And you know, I saw an opportunity there, and it accounted for 75% of my revenue. Even though I was selling other music, because I wanted to be a good entrepreneur, I wanted mm-hmm. to be like my parents. I was ambitious and motivated, and you know, I decided I was going to sell punk rock and heavy metal and hip hop and ska. And when people used to come in to buy that music, even though it wasn't much of my sales, 75% was the white power music. When people came in to buy this other music, and they were black, and they were Latino, and they were gay, or they were Jewish. At first, I was very standoffish, but I wanted to be a good businessman, so I bit my tongue, and I welcomed them in, and I took their money. And what I didn't expect, unwittingly, was that I was going to make a connection with these people on a personal level. And they
had really no idea who they're dealing with, or did they?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think that they did. I mean, Blue Island is a pretty small town, and I think a lot of the folks...
And they came anyway.
Yeah, I think that they came anyway.
Interesting.
Partly out of curiosity, I think, what was going on inside the store, along with the cops. Cops would always come in undercover too, and I'd call them out. And it was pretty funny. But, you know, these people and would come into my store and I would have my first dialogue with black people. And I started to realize after talking to same-sex couples that they loved their children the same way that I loved my children. And, you know, the Latino who had just broken up with his girlfriend felt the same pain that I felt when, you know, I had tough times in my life. And I started to really question my ideology because, you know, I'd been taught to hate people because they were different. And they weren't different. We were the same. We had the same feelings. And the empathy that they showed me and the compassion that they showed me really started to crack my shell. And what started to flood in and fill those cracks was my own empathy. And I started to kind of reconnect with my innocence prior to 14.
Listen, I got to tell you something. I've done radio 20 years. I've done 17,000 radio shows. Thousands and thousands of hours. I've talked to everybody I'd ever want to talk to. And I'm sitting here watching you speak, and I realize that you went to DePaul and got a degree in international business and international relations. Frickin' show off. But I'm just struck at the distance you've come from this. You read the book and you look at the pictures. I mean, you're saluting Hitler here.
Yeah.
And the verbiage in here is of women and blacks and is horrible and vulgar, mm-hmm. And you sound like you could teach a college class on anything.
I have taught a college class.
Oh, that's why I said that, because it's right there on your page. It's called a setup.
Yeah, I appreciate that, John. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
No, but I mean, it's true. I mean, I really, you know, people ask me all the time when I speak publicly, you know, have you really changed? Mm-hmm. And you know, for a while I'd say, yeah, of course I've changed. And then I realized I haven't changed. I am still that exact same person that I was when I was born,
right.
Prior to the age of 14. I was raised in a loving family to respect other people. I was taught to respect myself and to love myself, and taught to work hard. And that's who I was. That's who I am. And then for 7 years, from 14 to 22, I kind of went down a path that took me in a different direction.
It's 20 years since you got out of all this.
Yeah.
And I wonder from your perspective, when you see so much what goes on in the world, it's not getting any better. It's getting worse. Are we getting anywhere? We were talking in the break. We were talking a little bit about moving forward, going backwards, that we make these incremental steps. And I want to say what I said to you off the air. So many people wait for some political super deity to come along and supposedly make their life better. Never happens. You ever notice that? Yeah. Never happens. But we buy it hook, line, and sinker every time. But real change comes at the level of each of us doing our thing and breaking through our own chains. And when I'm reading your book, I'm like, this is how change happens. One person does this. Some kid, whether they're a skinhead or not, reads this and goes, I get something out of this. And there's a ripple effect from your experience. But I look at this and I go, and in some ways you turn on the news and we're screwed. No, not the band. We're screwed. Like, we keep doing this to ourselves. So when you go out and do these talks and you go out and spend time with the people that you had to, quote, hate, what kind, not the response you get, or even if they think you're real, but do you see change in that?
I do. As a matter of fact, I just came back from a talk yesterday. I was in Phoenix giving a talk to a college prep school, a Catholic school, all-boys school. And I spoke in front of 1,400 students and faculty. And I had, before my talk, I had one of the young men come up to me who was a student there and say, my dad's a skinhead. And we often have, you know, arguments about our beliefs. And it really struck me. Like, I don't think I'd ever had somebody come up to me and say that. Usually, you know, when I'm speaking, I speak to their, you know, to try and relate to the young people so that they don't go down that path. But I never expected a young person to come up to me and say, my dad's a racist skinhead. And, you know, it's completely against what I believe in. How do I deal with that situation? And it's really interesting. And I said, you know, don't battle ideologically with your dad, because you don't win that. It emboldens people and it makes them more angry. I said, tell him how you feel and start a dialogue with him. Because I can tell you firsthand from my own experience that my children, when they were born, when I was 19 and 21, were probably the biggest catalyst to my change. You know, when I held my child at 19 years old in my arms for the first time, That's when I reconnected with my own innocence. That's when I started to realize that even though my mantra and the mantra of the white power movement was something we called the 14 words. That's
14 words, yeah.
We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. That was our mission statement, right? As I held my white child in my arms, that was the furthest thing from my mind. I love this person. There was no hate in my body at all. And the last thing I wanted to do was get him or my wife involved in what I was in because it was so dirty and so ugly. And while I was still, you know, very passionate about the movement, something inside of me started to change and my priority shifted to my family and to the love versus the ignorance and the hate that I'd been promoting for 7 years.
You said a few minutes ago about don't battle ideologically.
Right.
Isn't that what we do all the time? Did you ever notice when you argue with people, no one ever wins? I don't even know why we do it, especially when you look at the political cycle. And, right. and I watch all this going on from a very observational point of view, and I said, this never changes anybody's ideas or beliefs. But if you share how you feel as opposed to you're wrong and I'm right, you're going to get a whole lot further in life.
Yeah, I agree with that. Look at our, you know, Republican debates lately. It's just a, you know, an ideological fourth grader battle.
It's like, well, yeah, I was going to say, 9-year-olds. Yeah. It's great.
And it doesn't accomplish anything. And right. It's more divisive, I think, than anything else. Right. And, you know, it's a real shame that the people who are vying for the biggest political office in the world as the leader of the free world are full of ignorance and promoting fear. And the rhetoric that they're spewing is just so against what we are as Americans. And, you know, it's really eye-opening. I think we have a lot to learn from what's happening right now. I don't know that there's a positive solution going forward mm-hmm. in what we're seeing right now and what we're faced with right now. But I think that it's a good learning experience because America is not our politicians. America right. is our people.
Right. And, you know, your parents coming over from Italy, mm-hmm. there was a time that you can go find any ethnic group. I'm German. Sorry, but I am. Any ethnic group that has come here has gone under the same undressing process.
Yeah.
And Italians are not accepted. So you look at this and say, you know, every time I'm watching television, which isn't very often, and I see a commercial to come to Japan and go on vacation, thinking 60 years ago we were bombing shit out of them.
Right.
Things can change, but we have to apparently go through this process of distilling who we are and who we're not. And, you know, some of the movies come to mind. I can't remember the one with Leonardo DiCaprio and you know, they're met at the Four Corners and they're talking about the original Americans. And yet they just came off the boat 6 years before. So we have a very short memory on how our country got this way. And we're still blaming groups of people mm-hmm. for our lot in life. This is frickin' America. Right. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Doesn't mean you're happy all the time. Just means you get to pursue it.
It means we have the opportunity.
The opportunity.
To do that.
And everybody has that to a greater or lesser degree. But to simply say, I can save your idea of this country. It's just, I'm like, who's smoking what now? What was this?
Right, and whose idea of this country are we saving?
Let me ask you this, because, and, you know, we're probably in the same boat with this, but I find it fascinating when they say, we're going to make, and I don't care who says something like this, we're going to make our country great again. And I'm like, to what year are we going to go?
Right.
Where are we going to... 1960, where exactly was that, where it was great for your group of people, but the rest of us were suffering?
Yeah, let's go backwards.
Yeah, I don't understand where they're going to, as opposed to where we should be going forward. Anyway, the book is called Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. Christian Picciolini is in the studio with me. A fantastic book, with an amazing foreword by Joan Jett. I read the foreword three times. I'm like, we're going to talk about her when we come back, and I want to talk about the chapter in there that was the most, I mean, they were all powerful, but about your brother. And the movie I was thinking about before with Leonardo DiCaprio was Gangs in New York. It's just, I've seen it probably 15, 20 times. And so much of it I'm ashamed of, but some of it says this is how we, as a country, apparently we deal with diversity, which isn't always a very good thing. The book is called Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. I have the author, Christian Picciolini, in the studio with me, courtesy of Katie Gibson. So this was a really good move on her part. First of all, the name. I'm walking over here and going, how does a guy named Christian live X amount of years of his life this way and still be able to go write his name Christian? Fascinating to me.
Well, for those years, I went by Chris.
So. Oh, did you know? Well, yeah, there you go. It's a good way to get out of that, right?
It was part of reinventing myself. I went back to my full name.
Yeah, you can't be a skinhead called Christian. It doesn't work very well.
Tough.
The foreword of this book is extremely well written by Joan Jett, who, if you know, is a legend in music. And can you just how you met her,
sure,
and what it's like for you to see this 10 years later on the cover of a book?
Yeah, it's really a pretty incredible story. So I met Joan for the first time in 1996 after I'd left the skinhead movement. I'd started a punk band called Random 55. None of your listeners will ever know who that is. But we got asked last minute to fill in a slot opening a show for her in Chicago. And we did so. And after our sound check, walked backstage, and I was pretty depressed at the time. This was during my depression. And Joan was getting ready to do her sound check. And she noticed me, and I was kind of sitting, you know, by myself. And she came up to me, and she put her hand on my shoulder, and she asked me what was wrong. And I didn't have the courage to tell her, you know, about everything.
Listen, if Joan Jett would have walked up and put her hand on my shoulder, I think I would have fainted.
She's a great person.
Yes, okay.
But she really showed me, you know, a lot of compassion at a time when I needed it. And loved our set, asked us to do several other shows with her, and got to become very close with her and her team and Kenny Laguna, her manager. She helped us out quite a bit. But more than anything, I think, you know, her show of compassion to me, I really needed it at that time. I didn't think I was ever going to fit into the normal world again. And, you know, she's fought her own battles. She certainly is a champion for lots of, you know, women's rights and gay rights and animal rights, and is just a very compassionate person, and grew very attached to her. And years went by, I hadn't talked to her after the band broke up. When I was thinking about who I wanted to ask to write the foreword for the book, she was the first person that came to mind. And even after 15 years of not being in contact, I reached out to her, and she was so gracious. She remembered me and agreed to do it, and it just blew me away. It was just a really wonderful foreword and an opening for the book.
Last night, 11 o'clock, I should be sawing the wood, should be in the land of Nod. I'm not, I'm reading this. And I would read some of the book, and I'd go back to the introduction. And I'd read some of the book and go back to the foreword. And I'd go back and forth and back and forth. And again, as I start out this little foray into your path, I'm looking for the threads. I'm looking for the threads. I'm looking for the connected dots. And you know this because you've lived it. You get to see those till you go through them. They're not ahead of you. Mm-hmm. And you look back, go click, 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 click. I'm sure there was no way you'd ever thought you'd write a book.
Right.
That you'd survive those years in the movement, much less have Joan Jett's name on the cover of your book. And putting all these pieces together, and if you never write another one, and I hope you do, because you're a very good writer, and maybe it's the other part of redemption in this, but I was struck with the chapter more than anything else about your brother, because it reminded me of the movie American History X.
Right.
And I've watched that a dozen times, and I thought, here, you know, similar, Ed Norton pulled it off. I don't see, you know, here's what happens. You see a guy in a movie like that, and you see him a couple weeks later and something else, like, wait a minute, how does this work? But it was a very powerful story. And when you were coming in, it's hard not to make comparisons, but you were saying some of that might have been...
Yeah, I mean, I think that that American History X was kind of a composite of several people. Ed Norton's character was a composite of several people, one of which I think is me. And I know for a fact that other people involved were people that I know. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of really striking similarities between that story and my life. While I didn't go to prison, mm-hmm. You know, I also had a brother who was killed.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was killed for the color of his skin. You know, he was buying drugs in a neighborhood. And a month earlier, there was a shooting between blacks and Hispanic gangs. And, you know, my brother with olive skin pulled up a month later to score some weed. And, you know, they thought he was somebody else. They thought he was an invading gang to come in. So because of the ignorance, mm-hmm. kind of came full circle, right?
That's what I'm saying. This is there's my, the connected dots here.
This is my story, and this is almost the karma, you know, that comes from what I had done to other people. But my brother, I feel, for a long time, I felt like my brother paid for my sins. Mm. And, you know, he was killed. He was shot and died. About 11 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that was also a big impetus for me to finally finish the book, because I'd started to write it. But when that happened, it kind of put everything into perspective, and it made it more urgent to tell the story, because it's a really cautionary tale about how a normal kid, because I was a pretty normal teenage kid, can get sucked into a really ugly ideology. I mean, we see this with, you know, young middle class girls from, you know, Michigan who are traveling to Syria to fight for ISIS. I mean, it's really not that different. The way that recruiters work, the way that the fear and the ideology sucks people in is exactly the same. And also the way that people get out of these movements is very similar. It's because somebody has touched them.
It's like detox.
Yeah. It's somebody has made their way to their heart and allowed them to kind of, get rid of all the clouds and stuff and see their life for what it really is. And that everything you believed in is a sham.
You know, there's so much in this conversation. I feel almost distended in some ways. We're talking, but I feel like I'm up in the corner listening to all this. And I keep thinking a couple things. Number one is the ghosts of the past that are inevitable.
Yeah.
Everywhere you go, you still have the tats, you know, you have a little bit more hair.
Less hair, actually.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, well, I used to shave my head. Now I'm just bald.
Naturally bald. That'll be the title of your next book, Naturally Skinhead, right? But the redemptive factor of moving through the world, parts of you attached to who you used to be, still carries with it energy that is very difficult for a lot of people, not just you.
I consider myself a constant gardener. And let me explain what that means. For 7 years, I planted a lot of seeds of hate, a lot. Thousands of, you know, people, hundreds of people that I recruited, and through my music, you know, I reached tens and hundreds of thousands of people. And when somebody walks into a church in South Carolina and murders, nine innocent people, or, you know, a skinhead walks into a Sikh temple in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, and murders six innocent people based on ignorance and fear and hate, those moments hit me very, very hard, because I know that because of those seeds that I planted many, many years ago, whether directly or indirectly, have, you know, influenced other people.
Contributed to that. Yeah.
And still do. My music is still out there. I have no way of, you know, of getting rid of that now with the internet. And, you know, I still see myself constantly pulling the weeds from all those seeds that I planted, which is why I started an organization called Life After Hate, to be able to help educate people on, you know, the problems that we're facing in this country with far right white supremacy. And then also to, you know, to really reach people and pull them out of these hate groups that they're stuck in. Because I know for a while I was involved, I dropped my ideology, but I couldn't get out. I was intoxicated by the power. I'd built everything around this movement, and it was tough to let go of that, even though my heart had begun to change, and it was dangerous to leave.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Life and death stuff.
So I've started an organization that actually, works to help people understand the threat, but also to help people get out and leave that lifestyle.
So that's part of this. How many, how often people come and say, I can't do this anymore. Is that happening?
It's happening all the time. We just launched a program at Life After Hate 6 months ago. It was a soft launch, didn't even announce it, called Exit USA. And it's a website that anybody can go to and anonymously contact us and keep the conversation confidential. They can call, they can text, whatever, if they know somebody or if they themselves are, you know, battling this. And we get emails, calls several times a day. We've helped in the couple months that we've launched it. We've got a network of about 40 people who are formers, formerly of that lifestyle, who are now doing really amazing things with their lives. And in fact, the organization itself is run completely by former white supremacist members, skinheads, whatever, who've done amazing things with their lives the last 20 years. And I'm really proud to say that we've helped change a lot of folks.
I was watching, I probably watched 10 or 15 videos on YouTube, which is one of the good things about the internet. Everything's out there. If you can't find it, that's your fault, because it's the electronic landfill. And one of the interviews, you made a comment about, you know, I'm an agnostic, but I hope that this has some sort of overarching meaning or something from a bigger place than just me and my screw-ups. And as I read your book, and I'm sitting here talking to you, and the way that it came together so fast. Hey, so-and-so, click, click, click. I look at those things almost as dominoes. Mm-hmm. You can use the word divine if you want. Whatever. I don't think there's a guy in a white beard keeping score. But there's something that moves us when we connect with it, for better or for worse. And it seems like in my observation, in my view of this, this is like a whole setup. Like, let's get this guy over here to be this way. And then, yeah, it's going to suck the big wazoo, and there's going to be some serious losses, but those are going to be lessons burned into his soul that for the rest of his life, he will be this guy. Do you ever come across thoughts in your mind, or you got time by yourself going, I signed up for this? Really?
Yeah, I mean, I think about that every day. We make mistakes in life. We all do. And, you know, we're all faced with different decisions, and we make wrong decisions and we make the right decisions, but we have to learn from every experience that we have. And I don't know that if I hadn't gone through that 7 years that I would be the person I am now. And so maybe it was a calling for me to, you know, to go through that and have a really immersive learning experience, even though it was detrimental to me and detrimental to my family and to other people who were victims of my hate. Maybe there's a bigger purpose for having learned those 7 years, because I've learned a lot since then. And, you know, I'm happy to say, and I'm proud to say that I've been able to help other people understand their lives as well. But we need to do more. I mean, as people, this is a topic. Racism is always kind of at the top, but we're so scared to talk about it because we don't know how. We don't want to offend anybody. We don't really know how to approach, you know, cultural differences. We think we do. You know, we sit in our offices and you know, with our privilege, and we think that, you know, we're doing the right thing by talking about it amongst our friends. That's not really the way it needs to happen. Is we really need to talk to the people who are being marginalized, to understand their point of view, to have compassion and empathy, and put ourselves in their shoes, literally, and feel what they go through and understand the obstacles, and then you know, take it to the people that we love and the people that we influence and try to change their perspective, if we can, to be something more positive than it is.
The book is called Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. Christian Piccolini is the author. First of, I hope, more books from you, because what you're saying comes not from theory, but from experience. And that's where the rubber meets the road right there. They say all change, no matter how small, requires courage. Some requires a little bit more courage than others. And what I hope people get out of this today, what I got out of reading the book and just sitting here spending time with you, is, you know, the setup is it's about being a skinhead, getting it out of a movement, but we're all in a movement of some kind. We need to figure out why we're in that movement, and if it benefits us and it benefits other people. If not, we need to take a hard look at that and have the courage to look at ourselves and look in the mirror and make the changes, because that's really where it starts. The foreword is written by Joan Jett. It's available at Amazon.com. And your website again?
People can go to romanticviolence.com.
Well, I'm really glad you came in today. I'm glad Katie said it was a good idea, and I look forward to seeing you again.
John, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. So after thousands and thousands of radio shows since 1997, there's been some constant things in my life that I talk about, and one of them is about change. And it is the thing we fear the most, but usually end up needing the most. There's a difference between what you want and what you need. I think the wants are the human part of us and the needs are the being part of us, and they always don't line up. We always get what we need. We always get what we need on the level for our higher self. Rarely is it the way that we want it. Easy, cushy, soft. But that's really what it is. We all want change. We all need change. We fear change. And this book, Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead, as I mentioned to you while Christian was on the show with me, yeah, it's about his journey, but I saw so much of my journey in it. It wasn't even about prejudice towards other people. It's about making change. So I encourage you to go pick this book up, and if nothing else, you'll see the change is possible. If nothing else in your life comes out of this show, realize the change is possible. You don't have to be the person you think you need to be, because that's what you believe you are, especially when it's not working for you. Challenging our beliefs is the thing. How do you know what you believe unless you challenge it? And the only way to challenge it is to experience it. And if it's not working for you, you got to be honest enough to say, it's not working for me. And then you change it. And then the ripple effect occurs. So again, fantastic stuff. Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead, Christian Piccolini. You can pick it up at Amazon.com. Is there still Barnes & Noble? If there is, you could probably get it there too. Adios.